Welcome to Baird's IPO Reboot Series, where executives can learn the ABCs of going public. I'm Tom Shadwell. I'm a director in Baird's Equity Capital Markets Group based here in beautiful Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In today's episode number 11, we will be talking about how to attract and retain the right shareholders on your IPO and how to get your sea legs once public. I'm delighted to be joined today by Jeff Bernstein, a senior managing director and head of Riveron's Equity Capital Markets Group. Jeff, I'll pass it over to you to give a quick intro on your background and focus.
I appreciate it, Tom, as always, and I want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving as we head into the end of the year, and hopefully everybody has a restful, peaceful long weekend. And I wanted to thank the folks at Baird who have been great partners to me over the years, and especially Tom and his group. My name is Jeff Bernstein. I run the equity capital markets business at Riveron. I've only been at Riveron for a few months, having most recently been at a company called ICR, where I was doing the same thing, mostly on the technology side with technology companies that were going public. I come from a different animal than most kind of capital markets advisors who get engaged by companies on a path to an IPO, where most folks had come from a capital markets background at one of the large banks. While I did do some of that early in my career, I spent 10 years at Goldman Sachs, ultimately leading the technology IPO and research sales and marketing business during Web 1.0. But I also have been a hedge fund manager for 12 years before turning to the advisory business, where I was investing across all sectors, finding disruptive companies that were upsetting legacy technologies and or business processes. So I come at this mostly from an advisor when I get engaged by companies. I feel that that is some value add. Riveron, for those of you who don't know it, is an older company, pretty large, had built a great business in audit readiness, SEC reporting, and all types of transaction advisory from an accounting and financial standpoint, M&A reconciliation, et cetera. So it's a large company that really helps companies get ready for a transaction and then execute a transaction from the CFO's standpoint. We also have a large investor relations and ESG business, and I came in recently to add a new business on top of all the financial readiness stuff so that we could offer an integrated package to CFOs on a path to an IPO or a dual track IPO sale. So that's really me. And we have great PE partners, by the way, in HIG and Kohlberg & Company, who are helping us continue to grow and execute.
Thanks, Jeff, for the background. Obviously, a wealth of experience, sell side, buy side, and now you're kind of sitting at the intersection of those two sides, as well as the corporate side as that true kind of independent advisor. And so maybe we'll put on a few different hats in today's discussion. And so as a former kind of portfolio manager, how do companies set themselves up for long-term success in the IPO process and beyond?
Great first question. As opposed to private investors who get a lot of amazing access to management at a lot of different levels, and who are kind of stuck with the position for quite a long time, public investors have more positions on A, and B, they can sell the stock. It's a liquid instrument. And so I think it all starts during the IPO process. And first, it's really about starting to develop a trusted relationship with those public investors. That's the most important. That trust obviously gets built over time, but because a portfolio manager and the analysts on the buy side can only focus on so many things at one time, building a trusted relationship with the company is critical. And for the CEO, it's really about establishing a reputation of thought leadership hands-on management where investors feel the CEO has a firm grasp of all aspects of the business, that he or she has a long-term vision that is clear and communicated effectively to the shareholders. And so there's that beacon, and a beacon that not only is near-term focused, but also long-term focused. For the CFO, it's about, you know, command of the key KPIs, how the finance organization has been built for the long term, where forecasting is an output of deep understanding of sales cycles, above and below the line costs, and endogenous and exogenous risks to the business. And then it's about that CFO, the consistency in the reporting that allows research analysts at the banks who are going to be publishing research, and analysts and portfolio managers at the funds, to look beyond the next quarter. It's a lot of it is about that. Your valuation is not determined by the next quarter. It's determined by the long-term confidence that investors have in that tail. I would say next, it's really about confidence without arrogance. And when a quarter may not meet expectations, you have to be transparent about why and what management is doing to address it. And lastly, it's about, as I said, looking beyond the near term and talking to shareholders about the product and customer roadmap in such a way that doesn't provide too much information for competitive reasons, but allows investors to attach some value to the long-term growth and profitability that will come out of that execution on those long-term projects.
Those are all great points. I think I'd highlight that the long-term vision as a key one, because at the end of the day, once you go public, you're supposed to be public forever. And if you look at the best stocks over time, it tends to be the ones that really do, that kind of have that medium and long-term vision and plan in place, and they're executing on that.
And that's the trust basis. Building. That's the trust Absolutely. Building aspect. You tell them in advance what you're going to do, and then you do it.
Exactly.
And you admit when things aren't going great.
The trust you need, the trust comes with the honesty. That's for sure. Yeah. So maybe just talk a little bit about kind of deal size and allocation considerations for an IPO to kind of set yourself up to be in a good position with investors over time.
Yeah. Really, really important. Obviously, you don't want to get off on the wrong foot. Obviously, you don't want to have analyst models, whether they're research analysts at the banks or analyst models from shareholders. You don't want to miss one of those first four quarters. You know, it just ruins your liquidity. It ruins your shareholder base, and you have to kind of restart. And so that all starts with the initial allocations on the IPO and how big it is and finding the right shareholders. And the recent IPO pricings of Arm and Klaviyo and Instacart and Birkenstock, I think, exposed some of the gamesmanship between investors and the banks in finding the right outcomes that could make both the issuer and the new investors happy and in it for the long haul. And selfishly, it's why I think I exist. It's why having a seasoned independent capital markets advisor, especially one that's been an investor in newly public companies, can be so important in getting companies off on the right foot. When the IPO market's hot, it's relatively easier to predict outcomes, obviously. But when activity's been more muted, like recently, there's a tendency for the underwriters, A, to misread the tea leaves during book building, during price discovery, and especially on allocations, because there's just not a lot of reps in the near term. And that's not to say in any way that the banks did these issuers a disservice. It only means that it's harder to predict, as investors, on the other end, are also bereft of recent experiences, and their behavior will be naturally more skittish when the stock starts trading, especially in an environment where economic data or political events are dominating market action. So in the cases above, while each was different in a lot of ways, in general, I'd say that not enough stock was ultimately spread out enough such that the trading activity could be less volatile from open through the first days and weeks of trading. Now, cornerstone investors, which each of these companies had, who can be very valuable on new issues, they may have received allocations that were so sizable, and of course, they're subject to lockups, that there wasn't enough stock to go around to others that would create an orderly aftermarket. In those cases, portfolio managers and their trading desks of the funds, and that holds for mutual funds and hedge funds alike, start to think about the true liquidity versus how much stock they were allocated. And if that stock opens up 20 to 40%, they may make the decision to sell, even though they said we were committed at the beginning, just because they have a fiduciary duty to do so. But they're also going to have a really hard time building a position of material size at a price that they believe they can get a good return on in the next 12 months or sooner. Just remember, funds are judged on performance and are often judged quarterly. So it's their duty to take profits and then come back to build something on another day.
Yeah, so we talked about kind of the near-term liquidity immediately post-IPO. But when you think about like the investor mindset in terms of how do they approach building a position over time in a newly public company, how do they tend to think about that?
Okay, and that's where I think that capital markets groups at the banks, as well as folks like me, can be really helpful and informative. The way I manage money and most funds do, you know, a 1% position is kind of a toehold. A 2% position is somewhat normal over the first year as a fund manager and the analysts get to know the company. So that obviously makes a big difference when allocating stock. If the fund's a $5 billion fund, you know, within a $100 billion fund complex, that portfolio manager manages $5 billion. A 2% position is $100 million. And that's if only one fund comes in from that mutual fund complex to want stock. Some funds, on the other hand, may only have 30 positions total, as they only invest in what they believe are best to breed companies for their strategy. So it's really critical that your lead banks have trusted relationships with the trading desks and the portfolio managers at those funds so that they can assess the real likelihood of aftermarket buying and selling based not only on the quality of the fund, but equally importantly, whether the fund has the ability to build a meaningful enough position to warrant internal research coverage and follow through over time. And it's for that reason that newly public companies may see in their first few quarters that their largest public outside holders are smaller funds and more specifically hedge funds. I know hedge funds and allocating to hedge funds they're made out to be fast money. You don't want to give it to them. And certainly some are, but many of them have really, really strong internal domain expertise in new, especially technology and healthcare companies, et cetera. And their PMs are more deeply committed to those new companies and are active enough and small enough to build a good position over time, whereas the large fund complexes just can't. Conversely, you know, those big fund complexes may have set up, because they can't build these big positions in a fund, they may have set up their own kind of capital markets desks or funds, which are often a euphemism for we're not going to get a large enough position on for any of our fund managers in the near term. So we have to manage it actively off our desk to maximize profit and wait for a follow-on offering where we might be able to get a big piece of stock on. So during the book build, it's really important to ask your banks and their syndicate desks really probing questions beyond, you know, the large fund complex and, oh, wow, I'd love to have them as an investor, that can really add to your understanding and thus how you should allocate your stock to achieve the results you want. And, you know, in the old days when up 40%, pricing at the very top of valuation and up 40%, like that did such a disservice to so many public companies and made shareholder bases just not long-term and tenable. And we're suffering the consequences of that now for a lot of companies.
I think you highlighted a really good point there, and something that I like to say too. It's like the equity capital markets, is specifically the IPO process. It's one of the last places where humans are really selling stock to humans. And it's the first time you're trying to determine valuations too. So it's not necessarily just the name of the fund. It's the individual sitting behind that position, getting them to have a stake that's large enough where they're able to track the stock in a meaningful way from a research capacity, I think often gets overlooked. not only just in IPOs, but I think in the public equity markets more generally sometimes.
100%, Tom. And that's why having either a really, really good, experienced internal investor relations person and team that really has a lot of experience, knows not just the fund, but the fund managers and what they look for in companies can be critical, along with, you know, folks like my IR team here, where we spend all of our time essentially trying to identify, and broaden and deepen company shareholder bases over time.
Absolutely. And so maybe we'll switch to a little bit of a hotter topic here, around like how should companies and selling shareholders look at follow-on offerings so everyone can achieve kind of their goals? What is investor appetite for secondary sales by company management insiders? Is there like a prescribed period of time people should wait for those liquidity events, or how should people think about that?
Well, first I would say that selling shareholders, selling shareholders, insiders, et cetera, if things are going well, public guys like me, we understand that going public is a way of getting liquidity for your early investors and your employees and senior management. And so as long as that trust is starting to be built and is built, we don't mind that. We really don't mind that. We will think about the timing of it, but we don't mind it. Okay. That's just, any good investor will not care. From a timing perspective, I always say, look, we've got to, you can't maximize it by having like a big event happen, your stock pops up and, you're reaching a 52-week high and then you dump a lot of stock on. I always say something in it for both sides in order to create that long-term shareholder base building. And so making sure that you're offering stock at a decent price and where there are events over the next couple of quarters that few investors who now are going to be, much bigger investors, they can have some upside based on events and based on, of course, on their own views on the market. So, this is where a company starts really getting its sea legs as well. And so, the shareholder base, when you do that first follow on, Tom, it's going to change. Often it's doubling the float of the company, et cetera. And you're going to give way probably from smaller and hedge funds and so on and so forth to much larger fund complexes. And that's where you're, again, trying to rebuild or deepen and broaden your trusted relationship with those funds. Most funds, as they have internal research that tracks the company, keeps earnings models, tracks performance versus peers, and has price targets based on a set of inputs. They're going to meet over time. You're going to, meet over time. And what they want is some upside, some visibility if they can. And so secondaries are very important, but all I can say is there has to be a quid pro quo if you want to have great long-term shareholders.
Yeah, and I think you've kind of seen that play out in some of the discount levels over the last 12 to 24 months in terms of kind of dipping into like the double digits versus maybe being in the high single digits historically, because investors that are going to come into the stock and kind of that first follow-on are looking for more liquidity. I think we've seen kind of smaller deal sizes as a percentage of the outstanding float. And if you're going to launch a deal that's a little bit smaller into already a little bit liquid stock, I think people have been adding an additional kind of illiquidity discount when they think about how to price out a follow-on.
But the good thing of that, look, you price at a discount, great. Especially if it's secondary, look, people have to accept that. And you're selling shareholders, everybody, inside or whatever it is, they have to accept the fact that this is just their first shot at liquidity. Yep. And that they've got that trust that gets built will hopefully yield a much better you know, next follow on or whatever it is, block trades, etc. But you said something early on about humans and humans. You know, I spend as a hedge fund manager, you know, and I you know, you spend a lot of time thinking about human behavior. You know, it's, I always say, you know, E gets reported four times a year, but PE changes every day. And PE is a function of the collection of human behavior. And so I spend a lot of time on charts, because charts to me are the visual representation of human behavior in the markets. And so when you're thinking about, you know, I'll spend a lot of time with companies that are thinking of doing a first follow-on about that, like, where have lines been drawn in the sand, as you can see by the charts? When has a lot of money come in and a lot of money come out? And those, you want to get it so that you're kind of in that tweener zone where, yep, when, you know, when the stock pulls back, you know, and so you offered the stock at 20 to a bunch of new shareholders, comes back into 18, you know that they're going to buy. And, you know, and you're not offering it at 21 when the 52-week high was 22 and there's not a lot of good news ahead. So really important to understand that.
Yeah, I think momentum can be key in some of these stories where there is a significant amount of overhang.
Yes, true. And
then maybe kind of switching over a little bit, when should companies hire an experienced IR person, and what is the role of outside investor relations in that case?
Yes, and I mentioned it a bit before, like that, you know, obviously, you know, the CEO, CFO, you know, the C-suite has a business to run. And so having a really good internal investor relations team or person that really understands who the best shareholders should be and how to go get them is really important. Now, some companies like to hire an IR person before the IPO. And it often is someone who has gone through an IPO with other companies beforehand, and they can be very, very valuable. But it's important when they come to your company that they come early enough so that they get to really learn the business. And so we often will say, if you haven't hired an IR person at least 9 months before your IPO, you might be best served by not hiring someone, having someone internal doing it, but it's not the long-term person, and then bring on an outside IR firm to work on that process, because we know all the investors and we know how to build a world-class IR program and so on and so forth. And this also allows you, once you're public, and if the stock's doing well, chances are you're going to attract a better person, unless you're like a, you know, top 10 unicorn, obviously. You know, and we also recommend, even if you hire an IR person, it's just a person. You've got retail shareholders that are going to come in, et cetera, et cetera. So having an IR firm that you kind of pay a little money every month just to help you with press releases and SEC reporting and Q&A for earnings calls and some road shows and so on and so forth. It's often good to just have, even if you have an experienced IR person internally, and we all often find, except for mega caps, obviously, that most experienced IR people like having an IR firm, outside IR firm, to help kind of arms and legs while not getting involved in your largest shareholders, but taking care of the smaller stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And then maybe we'll head into our favorite question, the last question I like to ask all my guests at the end of each episode. And your response doesn't need to be limited to just today's topic. So that question is, what are the three most important pieces of advice you'd give a company that is thinking about going public?
So financial readiness, the long pole in the tent is always the audit, generally. I mean, the markets for sure, but when the markets are okay, then it's usually being ready to have, you know, based on SEC rules, all your audits done so that you can maximize optionality of when you're going to price your IPO. So in that vein, and that's part of the reason I joined Riveron. We have this whole financial IPO readiness thing down to a science. You know, it's all ex big four consultants who have done all of this. And we just say, we always do it. We do it in half the time at half the price. So that financial readiness is critical to preserve optionality. I would say the second is early prep on other work streams. Start talking like a public company and not a private company. Start broadening and deepening your relationships with bankers, with the sell side research analysts, with investors. Start making sure you're honing in on the KPIs that they can grasp onto and that get them excited. Make sure that your banking syndicate is not just all of the same folks. In other words, some of the active guys are really going to be great at S1 drafting and marketing. And between your active underwriters, they each have specialties. Some are really good. They understand your TAM really well. Another banker might really understand your technology really well. Others, you know, have different skill sets. So, and then of course, everybody else in your syndicate, bring on folks like Baird, where the analysts are really engaged. They want to get to know you. It's not being passed off to some junior person. So build your syndicate as you would a football team with quarterbacks, you know, and so on and so forth. So I think that's critical. And so that early prep phase of, you know, especially if you bring someone like me in that's done this for a living, you know, cadencing all of that so that when you finally get to an org meeting, I always say I like to deliver companies, clients to the banks that are really ready to roll. And that lessens the stress from org meeting to pricing. So I would say those and build your team to be a public team. That team includes your, obviously your C-suite, but your financial, you know, making sure you've got great FP&A. FP&A is back in 21, nobody cared. FP&A is going to be really, really important. The ability to forecast, make sure, and we're seeing it with OpenAI and all of these things where, you know, your board is truly an independent and meaningful and valuable board, and governance is locked down.
I'm sure we could keep going for hours, Jeff, but I think we'll have to end it for today. Thanks, Jeff, for his time. Sure, your insights will prove valuable for viewers for years to come. If you'd like to get a hold of either Jeff or myself, I can find our info on our respective company websites or drop us a DM on LinkedIn. Thanks to our viewers, and thanks, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Tom and the team at Baird.